Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. We continue with the third episode with Dr. Robert Rosin of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri, on the history of Philip Melanchthon. In the first episode, we looked at some biographical and some background information on Philip Melanchthon. The second episode, we began our look at his time and his influence on the faculty of the University of Wittenberg and his influence on the education and a bit of controversy in some circles. Now in the third episode, we want to take a look at his probably most influential and best-known writing, the Augsburg Confession, and some other writings as well as a few other controversies that seem to plague him over the years. Dr. Rosin, welcome back, and could we discuss a little bit about the Augsburg Confession?
Sure, be happy to. In America, on public radio, there's a show called Car Talk. Two fellows with PhDs from MIT discuss how to fix cars. This is their job. They're really wonderful and funny, and they always talk about, welcome back to the third half of our show. So welcome back to the third half of Philip Melanchthon here. And we'll talk a little bit about Augsburg Confession and about the controversies. Some people say controversies. I think that's controversial in and of itself. But if you'll allow and indulge American English once in a while, the controversies that come. Philip Melanchthon did wonderful service for Lutheranism with the Augsburg Confession. I mentioned, I think, earlier that the Reformation is a little bit like a revolution. Revolutions can't go on overdrive forever. They have to be sort of settled down, and I don't want to really say institutionalized, but they have to be kind of regularized, brought with both feet back to earth, so that people in subsequent generations can easily grasp what's going on. The Augsburg Confession certainly helps Lutherans today get the sense of what is essential for Lutheranism. At the same time, that's not really what the document was for at the time. When Luther was condemned at the Diet of Worms, teaching Lutheranism was declared to be illegal within the empire, should not occur. There are legal proceedings then, appeals that were immediately invoked, and so princes carried on anyway. There was a meeting of the empire at Spire, a town in 1526, where people left saying, well, we really shouldn't be doing this, but we're going to teach what we can in good conscience, confess before God. That allowed Lutheranism still to go on. There was an effort in 1529 to stamp it out at yet another diet at the German town of Spire. Diets are political gatherings of the different representatives of the empire. At that diet, there was some sort of hanky panky, you could say, with the agenda and how a vote was taken. And Lutheranism was condemned near the end of the meeting after some of the Lutheran representatives were already leaving. Melanchthon was then involved with a group that remained to protest this decision to cease and desist. This is the origin of the word Protestant. Melanchthon's behind that. And then in the next year, Charles V, the emperor, is back in the empire. From 1521 till 1530, Charles was not around. He was off fighting a war against France while other parts of his empire were trying to hold off the Turks coming up the Danube in the east through Hungary and in through Austria. They made it as far as Vienna in 1529. There's always a fear the Turks might come again, might break through past Vienna, then the empire would be next. And so Charles would like to have a united front. What that means in Charles's mind, the emperor's mind, the Catholic emperor's mind, is capitulation, cease and desist. Why? Because you people, you Lutherans, are teaching an illegal religion, a religio illicita. Rome had condemned Luther as a heretic. He's been declared an outlaw by the empire. This should not be happening. Lutheranism should not be part of the church. The Lutheran princes decided that they had to make a stand at Augsburg. Melanchthon wrote a document using other things Luther had previously written. Melanchthon synthesized these into a series of articles, which basically are there to address the question, are we church? See, this is not just simply a religious confessional matter. This is a legal matter as well. If they're not church, then they have no right to exist within the empire. which is a Christian empire. If, on the other hand, they can demonstrate we are part of the Christian tradition, that we are teaching the Catholic small c, that is to say the universal Christian faith, then they have every right to be there and to exist. So this is a crucial, crucial question here. Melanchthon drew up these articles that were read in 1530 at the Diet of Augsburg, this political gathering in the South German city of Augsburg. Emperor Charles is there. Charles was not really interested in listening to this, but he had asked them to come, ordered them to come, and so he really is obligated to hear their statement. Luther, being an outlaw, can't leave Saxony. He can go as far as Coburg, the farthest castle south in electoral Saxon territory. It's still a good hard day's horse ride from there to Augsburg, and messengers went back and forth. Luther always anxious for news. There are times when he hears nothing because Melanchthon is negotiating with people behind the scenes. Luther's worried Melanchthon's going to sell out the movement. What's going on? You know, this communication being what it was in those days, he had reason to fret. Melanchthon, in Augsburg, on the other hand, is trying to, again, build bridges. We mentioned this before with Julius Pflug previously on a different show, different episode. Melanchthon's always trying to kind of stretch the tent as widely as possible. And at the same time, he wants to show that these Lutherans are well within the tent, well underneath its shadow, in its shade. They have a right to exist. The Catholic side, the Roman side, was not willing to accept the Augsburg Confession. They agreed with some articles, of course, God, Trinity, that was no problem. They had great problems with justification. Melanchthon would describe justification as God declaring people righteous. We call this forensic, a kind of courtroom motif, where we are simply declared not guilty, not for our own sake, but because Christ has stepped in as our substitute, our vicarious, our vicar, who's the word that is familiar to people in England, of course, one who steps in and fills a role as the parish priest. Christ is our vicar, takes our place on the cross. Rome was not happy with this. They wanted their other systems of justification, the kind of process of becoming righteous. They wanted that kind of talk for justification. Melanchthon didn't have that. There were other issues as well. They did agree that they did have the ministry. At the same time, the Lutherans said that it was enough for the unity of church that sacraments be administered and the gospel be rightly preached. We didn't need a certain number of candles, certain bells, certain vestments. All these kinds of things are not necessary. The Augsburg Confession, though, basically tried to lay out the idea, we are Christian, we are church. The Roman side rejected it. They issued a confutation, a rebuttal. A copy was not given to the Lutherans, but they took notes when the confutation was read. Charles ordered the Lutherans back into the empire with the Roman confession, not with their Augsburg confession, with their Lutheran theology. And so Melanchthon also then had to write an apology. That is not to say I'm sorry, but apology in the sense of a defense of the Augsburg confession, in which he expanded some articles, like Article 4, explaining even more on justification. The Augsburg Confession and then the Apology became the hallmarks, the touchstones for what it meant to be Lutheran. You see on churches today often cornerstones where it will say the year that the church was built, let's say 1930, UAC, Unaltered Augsburg Confession. The original Augsburg Confession is read at Augsburg. See, it's original because Melanchthon later would change some of the wording. This would later be involved in some of the controversies that would come, though not quite, I think, as popular opinion or popular thought sometimes might have it. It's a little more complex than that. We'll come to that in a moment. But Melanchthon's tone in the Augsburg Confession, Luther had to admit, was really the right way to go. Luther tends to wade in and wail away and be often rather blunt and colorful in his language. When he dealt with Erasmus over the bondage of the will, Erasmus had written the freedom of the will. We have the freedom to choose our salvation. Luther said, not so, God converts. Erasmus complained that Luther had been brutal in his language with Erasmus. Luther said he deserved it for being so foolish and so blind to what the scriptures say. Melanchthon, on the other hand, has a kind of deft and soft touch. And as far as Luther was concerned, that was important also here. You know, I mean, they want to be firm in their confession, but there's no point unnecessarily making enemies and picking fights. Just say what you have to say. Say it clearly, plainly, simply, and then let it go. And that's what Melanchthon did in the Augsburg Confession. Later on, he admitted that he probably should have added some other articles, papacy foremost of them, dealt with that. He didn't do that because this was an imperial, a legal diet of the German Empire, not a church council. And so he figured they could deal with papacy some other time. In fact, they did do that. In the middle of the 1530s, there was thought that there would be a church council. Rome was talking about having one. The Lutherans were going to have to come up with some kind of a faith statement, though they would undoubtedly be condemned at the council. In preparation for that, the elector, a man named John Frederick, he was the nephew of Luther's Frederick the Wise. John Frederick is now in charge of electoral Saxony. He had Luther draft a series of articles that could be used at a council. Luther did that. Theologians were brought together at the German city, the Saxon city of Smalcald, and Luther presented his articles, the so-called Smalcald articles. At the time, a lot of the theologians balked at signing these, not because they were objecting to the content so much, but it was more the procedure. They were told to come together, discuss things. This signing of a document was something new they weren't prepared for. Many said, we aren't authorized to do this. The Smalcald articles eventually would become one of the Lutheran confessions, one of the documents from the 16th century that helps define Lutheranism. At the time, though, they were kind of put aside. They still discussed theology, said, well, what could we say if there is a council? And it is in answer to that that Melanchthon wrote a thing called A Treatise on the Power and Primacy of the Pope. This, in the printing of the Lutheran confessional documents, often is bundled with the Smalcald articles. In fact, this is what Melanchthon kind of was missing with the Augsburg Confession, the part about the papacy. What he says there is the same thing Luther said in the Smalcald articles, namely, we Lutherans are willing to live with the papacy, provided that the Pope admits that he is purely of historical origin. This is not some sort of divinely mandated institution, but it is simply a matter of history. I hate to call it, say, an accident of history, because that, you know, it doesn't just sort of happen. It develops. But my point is that there are a lot of things that are just simply historical unfoldings, events. The institution of the papacy is one of these. If they would agree to that, said the Lutherans, and if the papacy also will agree to the preaching of the gospel that's going on in the Reformation churches, and if the Pope will actually act like a pastor instead of like a monarch within the church, then they were willing to live with it. That was the essential part of the Treatise on the Power and Primacy of the Pope. That didn't happen ultimately, but again, it was sort of an addition to the Augsburg Confession that Melanchthon kind of had in mind. It's another one of his contributions, very useful. The Augsburg Confession that I mentioned a moment ago, the unaltered Augsburg Confession, though, that later would become part of the Lutheran controversies later, after Luther's death, and even after Melanchthon's death. This is maybe not one of the best times for Melanchthon. If the Augsburg Confession and the treatise are kind of the upside, later on in his life, he has some rocky times as well.
So, as you say, you mentioned the unaltered Augsburg Confession, and later there is what's called the Variata. And again, you say this: some of the real controversies happen following his death. Can you go into some of that and tell us what he did to alter the Augsburg Confession?
Yeah, the essential point is around Article 10 that deals with the Lord's Supper. The original, or the unaltered Augsburg Confession, in the Latin says that Christ is vera ad sint. He truly is there. In terms of his body and blood being with the bread and wine, with and under, as Luther put it in the Catechism, vera ad sint. A decade later, in 1540, Melanchthon offered a different wording. Now, Melanchthon is often tinkering with documents. He saw the Augsburg Confession as sort of his product. Therefore, it's kind of his right to try and improve the wording to help the understanding. In 1540, he offered the language vera exhibeantur. We have the English word exhibited. It truly is exhibited or offered or tendered with the bread and the wine, Christ's body and blood, that is to say. And Melanchthon saw this as a little bit more concrete or a little bit more understandable than just is there. Part of the problem is that a lot of people will say, well, is can mean all sorts of things. It shouldn't. Is is basically an equal sign, grammatically speaking. Luther and Zwingli argued over is, and Luther says the second half of the sentence, the context, will help you define the meaning. And when Christ says, this is my body given into death for you, he's talking about his body, which is about to hang on the cross. The context is of his passion and death, not some sort of symbolic or figurative imagining of Christ there, but his real life, his real death rather, and his sacrifice, and so is ought to be clear enough. But for some people, it wasn't. So Melanchthon's trying to say it truly is offered. It's there. It's tendered. It's right there in front of your eyes. See, here it is, and this was language, actually, that Lutherans had used elsewhere in some of their discussions with other people trying to explain their own position. When Melanchthon offered it in 1540, interestingly enough, nobody really balked at this. It didn't raise any eyebrows then. It didn't even raise eyebrows in the 1540s after Luther's death when Melanchthon got involved in other controversies. It finally becomes a problem after Melanchthon's own death in 1560. In 1561, there were Calvinist theologians and a Calvinist prince who said, we like the Variata, the varied Augsburg Confession, better because we like the word exhibited. And as soon as they said that, the rest of the Lutherans said, wait a minute, if they like it, and they're going this Calvinist route of a kind of spiritualized understanding of Christ being present, then there must be something wrong with the wording. And then they start to back away from it, kind of later on after the fact. But for a long time, it really wasn't as controversial then. Today, we put UAC on the cornerstones to make sure that people are quite clear what we mean, which Augsburg Confession we're talking about, to make sure that people understand Christ is there in the bread and wine that we receive. It's not some sort of thing in our minds, or Christ is not somehow locally present in heaven, and we get bread and wine here while the Spirit sort of imagines him above, as you find in some of the different Reformed confessions. Melanchthon, though, got involved in other things during his lifetime, other controversies. When Luther died in 1546, Melanchthon came to the students at Wittenberg and said, gone is the horseman, gone is the chariot of Israel. You know, it was a very dramatic, poetic way of saying Luther is died. The mantle is going to fall to someone. Unfortunately, Melanchthon doesn't really have the kind of personality Luther did, the same ability to lead in the same way, and he got himself involved in a number of controversies. He would like to be seen as the heir apparent, but he doesn't want to sort of claim it, and yet deep down inside, I think we know from his writings and his private thoughts that he put down to paper that he thought he ought to be the next one to whom the mantle should fall. Didn't always do very well. One of the biggest problems came after the war with the Roman Catholics, the so-called Small Caldic War. Charles V tried to snuff out the Reformation finally by military force. It did not work very well. Charles won some major strategic battles, but never could really finish out the war. And so while he was trying to come to some sort of understanding with the Lutherans, there were a couple of interim agreements, one done at Augsburg, which basically sold out the Reformation. Most of the Reformation people objected to being asked to agree to this, and it was withdrawn. A second kind of interim agreement was then offered drawn up in the city of Leipzig. These are both from the year 1548, two years after Luther died, a year after the major hostilities had happened. Charles is still technically at war. He'd finally throw in the towel in 1542. But he's trying to come to an interim agreement for lands that he conquers and now controls. The Leipzig interim involved Melanchthon and his old friend Julius Pflug from the Roman Catholic side again. They agreed that three things. Lutherans could still say that we are saved by grace through faith, although you notice that the word alone is missing there. It could be said, but it could not be insisted upon by the formula. They secondly said that Lutherans could receive both the bread and the wine, both the body and the blood of Christ in the sacrament, communion in both kinds, as it was called, not just the bread with the cup withheld, as was the case with the Roman churches. And third, the Lutheran pastors who'd been married could keep their wives. So, your wife Wendy's very pleased, at least, that the Leipzig agreement is there. She can keep you or you can keep her. Seriously, this was an issue, this celibacy matter. It was thought, however, that this would be enough to kind of get the Lutherans back in. Well, a lot of them didn't want to be back in. The Lutheran clergy were asked to sign the interim agreement. In fact, in southwest Germany, for example, you could count the number of Lutheran pastors who signed it on one hand. Most of them simply resisted, they refused, or they fled temporarily. And then when the Catholic troops moved down the road, they came back to their parishes and took up their old Lutheran ways again with the Lutheran teachings that they had.
So, Dr. Rosin, do you think that Melanchthon really did sell out, or was there something else involved?
I think maybe the way to look at it is to envision Melanchthon a little like a boxer who's taking a pummeling. The Lutherans were getting beaten by the emperor in the war, being pressured by the Roman church, and so they kind of cover up on the ropes, as it were, and wait for the bell. They've got these main points, Melanchthon thinks, communion in both kinds, justification, and they get to keep the Lutheran parsonage intact, so to speak. Maybe that's enough to hang on for a while and wait and see if they can maybe make a comeback, you know. Just don't completely collapse, regroup, and then press ahead with their theology. I think that may be what he had in mind. But for a lot of people, they weren't satisfied. There were people elsewhere, pastors elsewhere, who said he ought to be stauncher with his support of Lutheranism. Of course, many of these were in places where there was no fighting going on at all. They've got good talking from some places farther away. This disappointed Melanchthon greatly. I mean, he's trying to do his best, he thinks, to salvage and to keep Lutheranism alive. Shortly before he died, Melanchthon made a little list of why now, near the end of his life, he did not fear death and was even looking forward to it a bit. On one side of the page, he said it would give him a chance now to see God and to finally understand many things that he only had wondered about and could not fully comprehend in this life. On the other side of the page, he said that he would be delivered from the acrimony and the fury of the theologians. He felt set upon. I suppose he felt a little bit bitter. People might have appreciated him more. It was rough for him. Some of it he brings on himself by his perhaps by his stretching of the tent a little wider than he should have. But that's easy talking in hindsight. I think, you know, we have to cut him a little bit of slack. And I think he really did try to do what he thought was best for Lutheranism. Would we have done the same? I don't know. I'm just thankful I'm not put in those kind of positions that he was. I think rather what we really need to do is kind of thank God for people like Melanchthon that blend with the Luther, that blend with other personalities to give us this Wittenberg faculty, this first generation of Lutheran theologians to frame things, to answer questions, to come finally to an answer. How do I find a loving God? It was quite clear from the works that they wrote, from the work that they did, that it finally depends on Christ and his grace. This is grasped by faith. It's the mercy of God, finally, that saves us. And for that, we give God thanks, and we thank God also for people like Melanchthon and Martin Luther.
So from Melanchthon's work or his life, is there something we can really hang our hats on and can learn from even today?
Well, there is educational interests and efforts. We can't use the curriculum per se, but you can still copy the attitude, being progressive and advanced in education, wanting to use the latest and the best in service of Christian life. And then, of course, there's something like the Augsburg Confession, the statement of faith that's there that helps define Lutheranism. There is a certain patience there in Melanchthon's side, and a willingness to explore, to carry the Christian faith into different avenues of life. He was still a classics scholar, but he did it knowing Christ and the gospel. He could reach out and explore the world because he knew where home was, so to speak. It's a wonderful place to be, with feet firmly planted, with eyes there on the cross, and then looking at the world around that God puts into our lives.
We would like to thank Dr. Robert Rosin for taking us on a whirlwind tour of the life and the background of Philip Melanchthon, his influence upon the Reformation and the controversies that surrounded his life. We thank you, Dr. Rosin, and we thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio. And if you have any questions or comments about our programs, please contact us at info@lutheranradio.co.uk. And if you'd like to listen to a podcast of this episode or any other episodes, go to our website, lutheranradio.co.uk, click on the podcast button, and find what you're looking for. Again, we thank you for your prayerful and financial support, and we look forward to seeing you again next week on the Lutheran Inquisitor.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.